You are listening to Bridging the Social Distance. My name is Jenny Mitchell, and I recorded this show here at CFRU, Guelph's campus and community radio station, as a means of creating a platform for us to share ideas and feelings and perspectives in the wake of this global pandemic that is COVID-19. I was afraid that people would get isolated or I would lose the opportunity to chat with my community and find out how everyone is doing, so I made this show. If you're listening and you would like to get involved or be interviewed, you can contact me at mobile@cfru.ca. I'd like to provide the disclaimer that these interviews were recorded at different points in time, so situations in some of these locations may have changed. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Jeff Royston over at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. This interview was originally recorded on July 15th, 2020. To start with, I would love for you to introduce yourself.
Well, I am Jeffrey Royston, they call me Jeff. I'm 98 years old, which is a bit of a handicap for most things. And I understand that you're interested in my life story, whatever it is. No one's ever written it, but I don't suppose they will. So, do you have any questions that you would like to ask me?
I'm sure I will have questions as we go, but to start with, I think leaning into whatever stories you want to share with me is probably a good place to start. Maybe you can tell me about growing up.
Okay, let's start from the beginning. I was born in 1923, which is quite a long time ago. And we lived in a housing, what do you call it, a community housing at the time. Mm-hmm. And we lived there for several years and then moved to a more salubrious place. My father, he worked for the, I can't think of the word, making musical instruments and that kind of thing. Radiograms, as you call them. And we had a motorcycle and a sidecar, which we used to use for going out on trips. And I saw quite a bit of the countryside with that. And then he changed jobs and he moved to a place called Mitcham. And work for Philips Electronics. Meanwhile, I was going to what they called technical college. About 14, I joined there, and it was a practical thing. There was theory involved in the system. But it was mainly practical things, which I have found to be very useful during my working life. I've never been out of work more than about a week or so. Because it was what you call a tool-making course. Now, I don't know what you believe or understand by tool-making. What does that word convey to you?
Well, trying to think back to your era, I guess, would tool making be like pieces of machinery? Like, would it be like parts, like stuff to work towards manufacturing?
Yeah.
Yeah?
We made, have you ever been around an automobile plant?
I haven't been in one, but I have an idea. Like, there's different sections of the building making different parts. And
well, there are a lot of machines in automobile plants, and we made those machines. That's what we did, the kind of thing. And I was in the design office for these machines. And what you do, you get a part drawing, and somebody says, we want to make this at a rate of 80 parts an hour, something like that. So now you've got an objective. You've got to make this machine that'll make this part for 80 parts an hour. And it's quite interesting.
Yeah.
You start off with a blank sheet of paper, and you've got to come up with the idea and how it's going to work. Anyway, I was doing that for quite a while. And I also worked for a propeller company, and that was very interesting. A propeller is a very complex thing. If you've ever really delved into a propeller, what it does and how it does it, it's quite complex. And I worked there for about a year and a half. And then came over here in 1953. I came to Canada by myself. I left my wife and two little kids at home until I got kind of settled in the And it was rather remarkable. The reason that we came here was because over there in England, you couldn't get anything. Right after the war, there was nothing. Mm. And it was quite frustrating. You couldn't get a house. All the new cars went for export.
Okay.
And I came over here by myself, and I lived at Jane and Wilson and worked for Avro. You know Avro, or have you heard of the Arrow? Avro Arrow is the airplane that Diefenbaker cancelled. And so I had to get into another job. So I got into a job. Was materials handling, where you pick things up and you stack things and you move them around and so on and so forth. But did that for a while. And where did I go after that? Oh, I went into an aircraft design office. Yeah, that's right. But it's not what you think it is. You work mainly on one part. The whole thing is subdivided into pieces that you can handle. And one guy gets a certain part and another guy gets a different part and so on. And I worked with him for about a year. And so then I went to the propeller company. That was very interesting. I've never been in a drawing office before where somebody has actually thrown a chair at the other guy. Put a nice little dent in the drawing board. that was a good company to work for.
Can I ask what provoked the chair throwing?
I don't know, they were just arguing about something and a guy picks up his chair.
Wow.
But another crazy incident in that place. Have you ever heard of the Bristol Brabazon?
No.
It was a big airplane anyway. Okay. And being a propeller maker, we were making the propellers. And I don't know if you know what contra-rotating propellers are, do you? Well, you get two on the same shaft. One shaft is hollow and carries a propeller, and there's another shaft inside it which carries another one. And they rotate in opposite directions.
Okay.
Well, anyway, one Christmas, it's always kind of party time the last week before Christmas. And here, you know, they just don't have liquor in the factories. But over there, they do. It's Christmas, they have Christmas. And we got these two great big propellers, which had been on display in a show somewhere, a trade show. And I they're about that one part, about far apart. And these guys are sitting there having their drinks and so on and so forth, and one says to the other, "I bet you we wouldn't walk between the blades." And he did, and this blade's he got away with it.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, it was terrible, yeah. But it was a good company to work for. So say I left there and I came over here thinking that we would get a better whatever you want to call it, chance of getting things. And I went to live with Jane and Wilson. And I got a job with Avro the day after I arrived, which was pretty good. And then after 3 months, I managed to get a house.
Wow.
Well, in those days, they had a defense scheme for houses. If you worked in the defense industry, you got a priority on getting a house. Mm. And that's what we got, one of those, the 9,999.
Wow.
And we've never really, a few setbacks, but we've never really been in trouble. After I left the propeller company, what did I do? Oh, I went to Conestoga College teaching. I was there for 8 years teaching in industrial maintenance. And that was the best job I ever had.
Oh, yeah?
You know, the hours were good, the pay was good, and it wasn't that arduous a job. And one of the first things you notice when you go get in the teaching business, you don't have to make a profit.
Yeah, yeah.
If they do something wrong, do it again.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, it sort of hits you when you go in there. Well, it doesn't matter whether this thing is good or not. And then I retired. Well, I got bowel cancer. And it came just exactly at the time when I should retire. Hmm. So I retired. And we were living in Beverly Hills, you know, that Jane and Wilson.
Is that in Toronto?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know the area a little bit.
Yeah, it's in Toronto, in what would you call it? What's the biscuit maker? I can't think of it. Anyway, Jane and Wilson is the area. And from there, we moved to Richmond Hill. And we lived there for, 40 years.
Wow.
And then, then we moved to Guelph. And the reason we moved to Guelph, are you familiar with Guelph?
Yeah, I grew up here and I live here still, yeah.
Oh, you did? Well, you know the airport.
Yes.
Oh, we lived on the airport. We had a house made on the airport. And I used to keep the airplane in the garage. And that was very convenient.
Yeah.
I mean, you could go almost flying any time you wanted, provided the weather was okay and so on.
I guess you probably couldn't find a place in Toronto where they would let you do that.
No, I didn't even look for one. You know, there was two vacant lots at the end of the road. And I was retired anyway, so we came and lived here. And we lived here for 40 years.
And you're still living here.
Yeah, probably it will until the end, which is not far away.
Can I ask you about some of these jobs?
Yeah.
Because they sound super interesting, and I don't know a lot about most of these lines of work. You mentioned you worked on the Avro Arrow, and then it got canceled.
Yeah.
Is that right? What was your job with that?
With the Avro Arrow, I was, again, my background has been tooling things, making equipment to make things.
Yeah.
And that's what I was doing on the Arrow. I was helping to tool it up, along with a lot of other guys. But they were, I think that was part of the reason why they cancelled it. They were tooling that thing up as though it was an automobile. Mm. You see, when you tool up an automobile, you're tooling up for 80 parts an hour, and it's going to run for 2 years. Every 2 years, they come up with a new design.
Right.
It's not much of in the way of a new car, but it looks different.
Mm-hmm.
And I was on the tooling part.
When you say they were tooling it up like a car, do you just mean that they weren't designing it to last?
That's one of the things they were doing wrong. They were spending way too much money tooling this thing up. They could have made the tooling for a lot less money.
Hmm.
But it was, you were tooling it up like you were going to produce a car.
What was the plane supposed to do if it had gone ahead?
If it had gone into production, you mean what was it supposed to do?
Yeah, like, was it related to, like, the army? Like, was it...
it was a fighter.
A fighter, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah. But my opinion, the days of the fighter airplane are pretty well over. Why do you need fighter airplanes? To stop the bombers. The bombers, the fighters are not a threat. It's the bombers you got to go after.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, and now it's getting to the state where the bombers are going to be obsolete because you can do it with missiles.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a pilot.
Mm-hmm.
You can send a missile off to do surveillance and so on. You can control these robots from California, and the actual robot is in Indonesia somewhere, mm-hmm. or anywhere around the world. Yeah, it's a whole new world of aviation out there.
Yeah.
If you send out a robot to go and blow something up, it's not coming back, so you haven't got to put gas in it to bring it back, and you don't need a pilot because the guy in California who's controlling this robot, he can see with this robot as well as I can see you there.
Yeah,
can see what's doing. So there's going to be a big change, I'm sure.
Yeah. Was there a big change when they canceled that project?
Oh, the Arrow?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, it was a tremendous upheaval. There was 14,000 people put out of work on that Friday. 14,000!
Wow.
And difficult part was they were all in the same business.
Oh no. And then you're all competing with each other.
You couldn't find another place like it anywhere. Well, a lot of them, they went down to California and they got jobs down there. And that was a great asset for the states. They picked up all these workers that they wouldn't otherwise get.
Right. Right. But you had just bought a house, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We had just bought a house and we got a couple of kids just going into school, so it wasn't practical for us to go down there. So we had to stick around and change for working on airplanes. I got a job with a company called Chain Belt, and we made materials handling equipment. We make sewage systems and things like that. It's a real change from airplanes.
Yep. Can I ask, when you said people were prioritized for housing if they were working in defense, your Avro Aero job, even though it didn't continue, it qualified you for working in defense, right?
So that's
a plus side, right?
Well, they told us over in England before we came that they set up stations over the country in England, recruiting people to work at Avro. Mm. So the day after I got here, I started work. And if the place hadn't closed down, I might have stopped there.
But it's neat that it qualified you for your house.
Yeah.
You know, it's a plus side for an otherwise unusual situation.
Yeah, otherwise I would have been like all the other guys, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a good thing.
Did you like go ahead. I was just going to ask if you liked the job you had after, even though it was so different.
Oh, the job I had after it was when I went to the chain belt company, which was a complete change from airplanes, concrete mixers and that sort of thing.
Were you still designing, like, the tools for the machinery? Like, were you still doing drawings and planning out machinery at Chain Belt?
Oh, Chain Belt. Yes, a bit, yeah. Doing all sorts of things. You were doing a far wide range of products. See, at Avro's, I was working on flying controls. And that's about all I worked on as far as the airplane was concerned.
Just the controls, eh? That's so neat.
Yeah, well, you know, those are the... Know
well, it's just neat that it's like each, I guess, like you said, that each person would have had a different part that they focused on. It's like such a huge puzzle picturing these different people working on different components that have to work together overall. But the idea of focusing on just one is kind of interesting. It makes sense. It's just something I hadn't considered.
One of the problems you run up against is as the actual airplane is being built, like they start off with a one-off, not with 50 or something like that.
Right.
Anyway, they start off with a one-off. I was on flying controls. And on flying controls, you've got the elevators on the tail. You understand? You and you've got the ailerons on the wings.
Okay.
And that is pretty well the extent of the flying controls. But it can get pretty complicated in places. So I was doing that, tooling that up.
So was everybody working on the one prototype, basically? To try to get the idea for the fleet?
Yeah. Basically, they were building the one aeroplane.
Right. What happened to it? Is the prototype still out there somewhere?
The first prototype is made of wood.
Oh, yeah. I heard about that.
It's almost easier. Just, you see, what would happen, though, you've got to make a controlled way back on the elevator and you're up the front in the cockpit and there's all sorts of things in between. Well, very often, the reason you make this prototype in wood is you go down to the hangar where they're building the prototype, and right where you want to put as a hydraulic pump or something, somebody's already put something there. So you've got to go and talk to this guy and say, hey, do you want to put, can you move that thing, you know, a couple of feet? That's the way they do it. They build the wooden model so you can actually see.
Right.
You're in one part of the office and they're there in another part, and unless you actually walk over and take a look at what's on this drawing board, you don't know what's there.
That's so interesting. So it's way easier for them to modify the wooden one to make extra space, and that before making molds and fabricating things out of metal. And yeah, it makes sense. I just never thought about it.
Yeah, it does.
I had heard about the wooden plane when I was a kid, but I didn't know why it was a wooden plane. Like, it didn't cross my mind it was because it was a model of one to be. I just thought they built a plane out of wood, and it didn't make any sense to me.
You're probably talking about the mosquito, right?
Oh, I don't know. I just remember as a kid them talking about this wooden plane. And
yeah, well, it was probably the mosquito. The Havilland made it. One of the reasons they made it out of wood is because wood was more available. All the metal, aluminum stuff has already been spoken for.
Yeah.
And there was nothing to make this thing with, so they made it out of wood. It was a very good airplane.
You're listening to Bridging the Social Distance, a show recorded here in Guelph at CFRU as a platform for sharing stories and perspectives during the global pandemic of COVID-19. This show is also being syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario. Today I'm speaking with Jeff Royston, a resident over at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. Oh yeah, so that one was not a model, that was a real just wooden plane?
Yeah, it was really.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I never worked on that.
No, but somebody has that wooden Avro Arrow somewhere?
I don't know where it is.
Could be in somebody's fireplace, for all we know. I don't know. Hopefully someone kept it.
Well, there are several of them still flying.
Oh, yeah?
There's probably half a dozen around the world that still fly. They come to air shows and things like that. One of the companies I work for, well, the reason I went to work for this company is because there was housing available near where they were. And we were making a car about the size of a Volkswagen with a rear engine, three-cylinder, which is and with sleeve valve, what I suppose you know what sleeve valve is. we better not get into that.
But you can describe it to me. I'm pretty, I can pick up on things pretty well.
Well, it was about the size of a Volkswagen. And you know what's meant by three-cylinders, do you?
Kind of. Like, I don't know a lot about cars, but.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, it was a radial engine. There's basically two types of engine. I don't know if you know, but there's inline and
radial?
I just said radial, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, this thing that we were making was a radial. And again, I was working on tooling the thing up. And again, same thing that happened on the Arrow. The government financed us on this, and then they cut the financing off, and they had to close down.
Not very good luck.
Very, very precarious, yeah.
Yeah.
And then I went to another aircraft factory, Gloucester Aircraft Factory. What did we make? Oh, we were making an experimental airplane when I was there, which was going to China. one of the first jets.
How did it go?
Hmm?
Wasn't go ahead?
Oh, that one went ahead, and we did get an order for this airplane from China. But there were probably, I don't know how many, a dozen or something like that. But even so, you've got to tool it up, otherwise you can't make it.
You have a life of tooling it up. Why would they have you designing that here to then send to China, like for the plans? Did China not do their own drawings or designs?
I guess they could design. Well, they do design their own airplanes, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the reason why they would do that. But maybe they felt they just didn't have enough experience for that sort of thing to do it.
Yeah, it's interesting that, during that era, I know there was a lot of focus on, military designs for things like planes. And so it's interesting to hear that there were designs being shared between countries, yeah. Not military ones, but just, the thinking in one industry, two countries are talking to each other and sharing designs. And then in another industry, everything's probably kept so secret and so private, and you don't want anyone to know what you're designing, and it's just unusual.
Yeah, there was moderately more security there when we were working on those airplanes.
Mm-hmm. What do you think your favorite job was?
What was the best job?
Yeah, what did you enjoy the most?
Well, that's hard to say. I think probably the teaching one.
Which one was that?
The one at Conestoga College.
Oh, yeah. The teaching one, yeah. That makes sense to me. I know you, it's kind of, I teach radio sometimes to kids, and it's like to see other people getting the tools to make their own things with it is really beautiful. It's different than doing the work yourself. It's just a kind of a completely different philosophy, I guess.
And the overall experience that I got certainly helped when I was making my own airplanes.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. I want to hear about your airplanes.
Well, why and how it worked, I've always wanted an airplane. I already had a license. I got the license. And that, by the way, is quite a difficult. It's easy enough to do, provided you've got the money. The hardest part about flying is paying for it. Anyway, a long time ago, I went to an air show at Markham, just north of Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And the home built, as we call it, movement was just getting going. And one of the guys flew in with his home built, tiny little airplane, only 16 feet across. But he said to me, "Would you like to fly it?" And I really shouldn't have. But I did anyway. I took it and I flew it, and I was so impressed with the way it flew that I thought, this is what I want. It was aerobatic. Do you know what that is? Aerobatic.
Does that mean it can move quickly and as opposed to giant swooping movements?
Yeah, loops and rolls.
Yeah,
and things.
Yeah.
And it responded to the controls so quickly compared to a Cessna or something like that. I sometimes think that the controls on a Cessna are joined up with rubber bands. but anyway, that's what I wanted. So I started looking at the home-built movement and well, yeah, it's feasible. You can do it. There are quite a few designs on the market that you can pick one you want. And that's important. Before you start to build, you're going to decide what you want to do with the airplane. Mm-hmm. If you're not interested in aerobatics and that sort of thing, and all you want to do is go from A to B, well, there's all sorts of designs that you can do that. But, you know, I wanted one of these, so I had to make one. And eventually I started building, and it takes about 3.5 years. If you start from scratch, which there was no kits, by the way, all you got was a set of drawings.
Wow.
And you had to make the airplane. You had to find all the material, and that was quite a difficult part. You had an engine and propellers and wheels and things, and make the rest of it. And on average, it takes about 3 years. But wow. My two did anyway. And one of them was made of wood, the first one I made. And the second one was made of metal, was aluminum. And of the two, aluminum, for me anyway, was better than working with wood. For one thing, you don't get all the wood dust.
Mm.
I used to get nosebleeds from breathing in the wood dust from working with all this wood. But with aluminum, all the particles, they just fall on the floor and you sweep them up. But you can't do that with wood. Well, I couldn't anyway.
Yeah.
But the first airplane was wood and the second one was aluminum.
What are some of the other differences between working with those two materials?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what are some of the differences between what will end up being a wooden plane or an aluminum one? I know you mentioned the dust, but, like, what does it change about the plane itself and how it flies?
Nothing, really.
Mm-hmm.
They both flew very much the same,
hmm.
whether it was wood or metal. But there's another advantage that metal has over wood. The first airplane that was made of wood, it was skinned or covered, as they call it, this 1/16 plywood.
Okay.
Now, this plywood is glued on to a framework. And you're gluing a fairly large area when you one at a time. And you have to work very quickly before the glue gets too sticky that you can't use it.
Yeah.
But with metal, it's not like that. With metal, you can stop halfway through a rivet if you like.
Right.
You know, you'll rivet in a big panel, and you'll put in all these rivets in. But you can stop halfway through, finish it the next day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather work with the metal than with the wood. And it's not so bad as far as dust is concerned.
Yeah.
All the dust when you sweep it up.
Never thought about these things before. Like, it would be very stressful to work on a project where you had to do, like, all of the gluing for a huge area in one moment. Like, I don't know, the way I craft, it's hard for me to wrap my head around that kind of pressure. You know, I like sewing, for example, and sewing's more like you're describing the metal. You can stop partway through and nothing's gonna go wrong. If you want to go have a coffee and come back and pick up your stitching, you're fine.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah. Gluing is a whole other world.
Take a look at that bed cover there.
I can't see it, but
you can't see it. My wife made that. But the problem is, she made this thing, and it's made of squares all put together.
Mm-hmm.
And you put something on that, walk away, and when you come back, you can't find it. For camouflage, it's wonderful.
That's amazing.
Anyway, I've learned since I made those two that if what you want is an airplane, you'll probably be better off to go out and buy one.
Right.
I'm not talking about a certified airplane. I'm talking about amateur-built airplane.
Yeah.
There's always a few on the market, and there's an awful lot of them that get started and never get finished. The guys, they just give up after a while. It's too much for them. So if you want to get one, look at the home-built market. You could probably pick up what you want quite cheap.
Is it risky picking up a partly done project, though? Because if you don't know what you're doing, it must be hard to check the work that's been done, right?
That is one of the problems. That's the guy made a good job of it.
Yeah. That seems kind of terrifying to me, trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you have a background in the designs, so I feel like even if you're following drawings, you still understand why the drawings would look the way they would, right? Like, you could look at the drawings and know why the designs are done that way, I would guess.
You mean, why is the thing done so? Why is the wing put here, for instance?
Like, presumably you would have more experience with that than some people starting these projects, right?
Well, you have to make an estimate of where the center of gravity is going to be. And then you have to work on that. That is your master point. Everything relates to that. It's got to balance.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I know what you mean. How do you decide on a monoplane or a biplane?
Well, I just imagine when you're describing people out there working on these projects, I would be surprised if many of them have a background in the design. You know what I mean? Like, and you worked on planes and automobiles and tools so many different times that even if you're building one that's completely new to you, you'd still understand the science and the mechanics behind it. I'm sure if you saw something in the drawing that didn't feel right, you'd know how to, like, adjust it or something, right? Like,
something looks wrong. It probably is wrong. So
you better
investigate it.
Because I could picture people going into this who would not know what would look wrong. They wouldn't have any frame of reference for it.
That is a problem. If people start doing it, they really shouldn't.
Yeah. I don't think it's enough to want to fly. I think you probably need some more understanding.
That's a great moment, you know, when you got the airplane finished and you've done all the checks and things you have to form, you have to fill out, and you sit on the end of the runway and you're going to fly. Is this thing really going to fly?
Wow.
Or is it just going to run off the end of the runway?
Oh, man. Is that kind of scary?
Well, it's a bit of a tense moment whether it's going to fly or not. But usually, well, practically always they do. Mm-hmm. If you're making a proven design, there's not much to worry about. So long as you follow the drawings, okay,
mm-hmm.
Not much to worry about. But if you designed your own airplane, now that's a different thing.
Yeah. Do you have to get them, like, inspected before you're even allowed to fly them?
Well, most people that build airplanes have already got a license.
Yeah.
They do understand a bit of the problems. I must admit, on the second one I've made, I got the engine a bit in the wrong place, and it was nose heavy or tail heavy. Anyway, when it came out to land, I couldn't keep the nose up. It was a bit scary.
Yeah.
But what you do in a case like that, I moved the battery. The battery is a very heavy article. So I put the battery right in the back in the tail. And that cured the balance problem, yeah.
That's pretty smart.
Yeah.
But you don't, I just was curious, when you build your own plane, if there's like any kind of inspection process before you're allowed to go in the air with it.
Oh yeah. You have to have it inspected.
Yeah, okay. That would at least take a little bit of the fear away. If somebody's looked at it and it checks out, you know, then at least there's some confidence that it should work.
It should work, yeah. But the inspector's got a very difficult job because he can't see everything on that airplane that you've done. So what he'll do, he'll ask you quite a few questions, you know, so unobtrusively he'll ask you about something, if you've used a bit of plumber's tubing or something like that. Well, you should use a piece of aircraft tubing. He'll condemn it. You can't try it. But they don't hang around to see that that's fine. they inspect it, give you a piece of paper, and it's up to you. Do you really want to go fly this thing?
Yeah, I guess with such a high risk situation, you probably want to be pretty honest with that inspector.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You probably don't want to be lying about what type of tubing when you're going to be up in the air with it.
No, that's right. Yeah. You got to do it the right way.
And, where did your planes go?
Where did they go?
Yeah.
Well, they both got destroyed.
Oh. And,
let's see, which was the first one? Oh, the first one was the one that I built. I put over 1,000 hours on it, so it was pretty reliable. Mm-hmm. But the guys that bought it, I don't know if you know the basic difference between the two types of airplane. One has got a nose wheel, one has got a tail wheel. Have you ever noticed that?
No, actually, no.
Well, next time you go out to an airport, take a look.
Okay.
One of them's got a wheel at the front, just under the nose of the airplane, and two other wheels.
Yes, okay, I know what you mean. Yeah. Like, so some of them are near the back, near the wings.
Yeah, wheel at the back, yeah.
Yeah.
The ones with a wheel at the back are much more difficult not to fly, but to land and take off.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could explain it to you, but...
I think I understand, though, because if the wheel's at the front, when you come in to land, one of the first things to hit the ground is going to be those wheels. So you can plan it.
It's the one with the wheel at the front that is the easiest to fly.
Yeah.
I used to say, if you learn to fly on a Cessna, which has a wheel at the front, they shouldn't give you a pilot's license. They should just endorse your driver's license.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, you should learn on the difficult one so that you're covered for all of the situations. Yeah.
So, and then the other types, there's low wing, you know, where the wing is on the bottom, and there's high wing, and there are biplanes. Mm-hmm. So what do you want? Mm-hmm. The low-wing monoplane is the one that's getting most use these days. Biplanes, though, you can build very strong for not much weight. You brace one wing against the other, and it's like making a structural box that deep, how far apart the wings are. They're very strong.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't get very many structural failures. You don't see it very often.
So what was the one you sold? What the wooden one? What kind was that?
Yeah, the wooden one, the first one. It was a nice little airplane. But
wheels at the back?
The wheels at the back, yeah. It probably has something to do with it. But I remember looking out my front window on that particular day and thinking that this is not a very good day to go flying. It was gusty and the weather just wasn't any good. And they ran off the runway. And I don't know if you know the airport there very well, but yeah. It's up on about two-thirds of the way along. It's up on a bank. And then there's the road, and then there's the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran down that bank. They landed, and then they ran off the runway down the bank, and the airplane turned over and broke the main spar and a few other important pieces. And that was the end of that one. And then the other one, what happened? Oh, I know, the metal one. This is a very unusual accident. A tornado came down the driveway and took out the garage where the airplane was and the hangar and half the house.
Okay.
So we had to live in the Holiday Inn for about 6 weeks while they rebuilt the house. But the airplane was just flattened. There was nothing.
Wow. That's terrible.
And I only had it finished 6 months.
I'm sorry. That's a very unusual situation.
Yeah. And there's two kinds of insurance you can get on airplanes. There's in motion and not in motion, mm-hmm. or you can go without. And I elected to go without, so I didn't get any insurance on it. But if somebody said to you, a tornado is going to come down your driveway and wipe out your air, wouldn't you say either?
Yeah, no, I know what you mean. It's like when you have the type of insurance on a car you're not going to drive. It doesn't seem likely that anything's going to happen to it. Like, I understand why. If you're a good pilot and it's sitting in a hangar, it should be okay.
Oh, there was nobody in the plane at the time. I was at the college looking out the window. It really was a bad storm.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It just wasn't salvageable. There was nothing that you could really use again.
Oh. Well, that's quite a story.
And there I'd figured I'd get an airplane to last me the rest of my life, because it was a metal airplane.
Yeah.
But it was gone in 6 months.
I'm sorry. That's hard.
Too bad. Yeah, it was too bad.
Wow.
So I went out and bought one. Like I was saying to you.
Yeah.
For less than I could have paid for it if I had made it. It was a homebuilt. It was a beautiful airplane. And it flies beautifully, or it did.
Yeah.
I went out west. I got rid of it when they told me I couldn't fly anymore. Well, I can. I've still got a license, but I have to have another pilot in the airplane.
Yeah.
To cover up, you know, in case something goes. I get these things called TIAs. Do you know them?
Are they like little mini kind of blackouts?
That's right. It's a terminal ischemic attack. I could have one right now. I just dropped down on the floor.
Wow.
Or a doctor. Yeah. So not only did they cancel, well, they canceled pretty well all my licenses, even my bicycle riding license, which doesn't, you don't need one. But that was another phase of my endeavor, if you like, call it that, bicycle racing.
Oh, wow.
You used to hold a record at one time. This is over in England.
That's awesome.
A 30-mile, 30-mile time trial.
Wow.
You don't start in a group. That's mass start. You start at many intervals. There could be 50 people in the competition,
mm-hmm.
and you will start at many intervals. Like number one will start at 1 minute past eight. And number 15 will start up 15 minutes after. So when they come in, when they finish, they ride out. Well, in this particular race, we rode out 15 miles and 15 miles back.
Yeah.
Come back, you give your number as you go over the start line, and it makes it easy for them to get your total time. Yeah, we used to do a lot of... Well, we used to race nearly every weekend. But you had energy in those days.
Yeah, a little different right now.
Oh, it's totally different, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's harder than mass start. Well, you know what mass start is, you all start together.
Yeah.
But the guys in the middle of the pack, they're not working as hard as the guy up at the front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but everyone else is like,
everyone
got the wind or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
He cut the wind out, yeah.
Yeah, it's like a flying V of birds.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So it's, something I've forgotten now. Oh, so it's a maximum effort thing all the way. If you're going to win, you can't slack off, because simple starts. You have to go as hard as you can all the time, because nobody knows who's won until the last guy has crossed the finish line.
Yeah.
So you then shut off, but in a mass start, you know where everybody is.
Yep.
You can afford to drop back and rest for a bit in the pack.
But if you get up to the front, you've got to take on all the work.
When you get up on the front, you do it all the work. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last mile is where most of the action is, because everybody's trying to get up the front and stay up the front.
Yeah.
And they can't all do that. Only a few of them can. So we used to do a lot of bicycle racing. But there again, the war affected us, because you couldn't get bicycles.
Right. They would have wanted those parts.
The ones that were made went into the Army or the Air Force or something. And they weren't any good for racing anyway. But you see, as you go around the course, you see guys at the side of the road lying down on the side of the road. They just exhausted themselves.
Wow. Well, Jeff, I guess I've got to wrap it up, because it's been an hour. Thank you so much for chatting with me today.
Well, thank you for coming. I enjoy talking about these things.
So once again, that was Jeff Royston, a resident over at the Village of Riverside Glen Retirement Residence. That brings us to the end of this episode of Bridging the Social Distance, a show produced at CFRU in Guelph and syndicated for CIOI in Hamilton, Ontario, that aims to create a platform for us sharing what we are doing to get through this time together in the wake of COVID-19.